each side has 15 minutes. And so that means for the appellant, that's 15 minutes total. Now, my understanding is that Fair Housing and Mayling are going to share time, but I understand there's been a change and that Fair Housing will take 11 minutes and Mayling will take 4 minutes. Is that correct? All right, I see parties nodded, and so I just want to, I want to give you a little bit of, you can still stay there where you are, and Ms. Ling, my understanding is you're going to argue from council table, correct? Okay, thank you. All right, now, when you share time, basically, you have 15 minutes total, and I'm going to expect you to stay to your time, and I'm going to call Fair Housing first. And then I'm going to call you, Ms. Ling, last. And but one thing that I want to tell you is they have 11 minutes. And if we're still asking questions and we take Fair Housing over the 11 minutes, like you both of you have seen in other cases, I won't let that cut into your time. You will have your 4 minutes no matter what. Okay? So you don't need to worry because I see people at council table. But on the they get nervous, and then they think, oh, they're using up all my time. What do I do? You will have your 4 minutes. But if we have additional questions of Fair Housing, that's on our time, and we don't count that against you. That being said, if we don't have additional questions, when the clock hits 11 minutes and I'll ask it, then I'm going to ask you to sit down, and we'll go over to Ms. Ling. And since you are both on the same side and you've decided to split your time, Ms. Ling, when your time comes up, if there are things that you agree about that they've said, you can tell me that and you don't need to repeat them because you're only going to have 4 minutes. So you don't want to re-argue things that the time's already been taken. All right, so we're going to go back to the appellant, you have 15 minutes total, so if you can state your appearance and tell me aspirationally how much time you would like to save for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. David Zients on behalf of Relm & Colfax, PLLC. Aspirationally, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, this appeal concerns two sets of issues, a matter of contract interpretation that applies to all parties, and additional questions specific to Ms. Ling. I hope to address both sets of issues, but would like to begin with the contract question that applies to all parties. The District Court held that the agreement was unambiguous, that the only reasonable interpretation is that paragraph C of the fee provision establishes a default rule under which the Relman firm is not entitled to a one-third contingency fee. If that interpretation is not unambiguously correct, the decision needs to be reversed.
Well, let me jump in on that, just, I think, because we understand that part of the law. So you're here to convince us that it's ambiguous and it needs to go back and take extrinsic evidence, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So the type of work that you do, you had this contract with both of the parties, correct? And it's basically the same language.
Correct.
So we're not in, and they fire you before the government comes in. You're 6 years in, and then the government settles it 3 years later. Certainly there's proximal, it's proximate. Your firing is proximate because the government comes in the next day, and I know that you referenced an email. When you do contingency work, of course you want to get paid. And when you do this type of work, of course, the government does sometimes come in, and you anticipate that. So I would agree with you in the sense it could have been more clear, but you drafted it to say, if we are terminated, this is how you determine our attorney's fees in C. But you didn't do that, okay? But what else could C mean? That's, I guess, it's because obviously you have to be, when you take contingency C, contingency fee cases, you have to be concerned about people firing you or the government coming in. Those are real possibilities. And you're putting out all this money and you want to get paid if someone else comes in and takes over. You want to be paid for what you've done moving the ball forward.
Sure, Your Honor. So a couple responses to that. First,
did you just badly draft this, or what?
Your Honor, no. I think there's a reason why this was drafted the way it was, but I think there is also a more fundamental point that I think was throughout the district court's opinion, this idea that a law firm drafted this and we really ought to hold it against them. Under D.C. law, that's not actually how it's supposed to work. The first question is you look at whether there's an ambiguity. You don't take into consideration who drafted it. Even at the next step, what the D.C. Court of Appeals says, construction against the drafter is the last resort. You don't get to that until you've considered all of the extrinsic evidence, which the district court did not do, did not send to a jury. So it's really, I think this is a good question, but it comes at the end and not the beginning of the analysis as the district court did it.
And you run a business, you have to worry about getting paid, and getting fired or the government coming in are two real things when you do these type of cases.
Sure, Your Honor, and I don't think there's a dispute between the parties about a firing, depriving the Roman firm of its fee or of government intervention. I think there was agreement. There was some initial dispute, but ultimately I believe the parties agreed in the district court that the Roman firm substantially performed and it's entitled to its fees under the agreement. Your Honor, you asked, what else could paragraph C of this contract could be doing? I think when you look at paragraph A of the agreement, it's actually quite clear what paragraph C is doing, why it is in the contract. So, paragraph A, the reason you have this provision that is very specific to a question of a settlement with waiver, you do have a worry where, if you don't have something that specifically addresses the waiver scenario, a defendant could say, okay, I will settle with your client, but you have to take this to your client. I want to cut you out, waive fees, and then you're ethically, you have to take that to your client. So the idea of paragraph A is to make sure that in the waiver scenario, the firm is protected exactly as you suggested. Paragraph C comes in order to make that work. So we have...
So why is paragraph C a standalone separate paragraph following B that doesn't have anything to do with A? And if your argument is that C describes how the fee will be calculated for A, why isn't it there?
Well, Your Honor, we have at the very end of A, this is at page 115 of the excerpts of record, it describes actual fees calculated in the manner described below.
And below does not have one-third contingency.
Well, Your Honor, the comparison is one-third versus actual fees, whichever is greater. So what A is telling you to do is calculate one-third, calculate actual fees in the manner described below, and then the Relman firm gets whichever is greater. So that's why the scenario would be the firm put in $250,000 of work and there's a $500,000 award. In that case, one-third would actually undercompensate the firm. And so this comparison lets you say, in that case, you get the actual fees.
So, counsel, I think I'd probably agree with you that in A, when it says actual fees, C is how you would figure out that actual fees. The problem is, isn't it kind of a fallacy to say that just because that's true, that this is not also the way to figure out actual fees in the circumstances where the C is how you figure out actual fees if A and B don't cover it? You know what I'm saying? In other words, you can be right, and I think maybe you are right, that's how you would figure out C is how you figure out actual fees for A. But that doesn't mean the problem you have is that A doesn't cover your situation. There was no waiver here, right? And B doesn't cover it. They both clearly, A and B clearly don't cover your situation. So C is left and C covers. So I don't, in other words, it doesn't matter to me whether or not C is how you do A. That could be true, and it could also be what covers your situation because A and B aren't implicated in your circumstances.
Sure. A couple of responses to that, Your Honor. One is that, when we read legal text, we say you don't expect to find an elephant hiding in a mouse hole. This is, I think I agree with the premise of your question. If you look at A says go look at C to figure out how to do that calculation. That is a very narrow role. And then to read into paragraph C that I think we agree performs that, narrow technical role, also dramatically changes the nature and scope.
I guess what I'm struggling with is like, something that it makes sense to me that you have a contract because this is how we're going to figure out our actual fees, right? But what you're saying is that would only, that we should somehow read that as only having a very narrow role you know, if you didn't have A or B, if A or B were just missing here, then you would just get your fees, and we would look at C, and you would get your fees, right? And A or B are missing here because when you read them, I don't think you agree that A and B don't cover your circumstance.
Sure, we have. I think there's a few ways of interpreting this contract, which is kind of, you know, the premise of the argument that there was an ambiguity. One is that you can look at the last sentence of paragraph B and interpret that as applicable in our scenario of a settlement with no waiver. I think the response to that has been, well, that requires taking a more kind of isolated look at that last sentence. That last sentence doesn't say anything about summary judgment. It doesn't say anything about trial. The response we've heard is well, you got to read it in context with what comes before. That's really our point about C as well. I think another sort of separate point about why this paragraph C reading that the district court adopted doesn't work. You know, the contract is quite clear throughout the
okay,
types of
I guess though, but let me. You're not. Do you concede you're not A, B, or D?
Your Honor, we think there is a reading of the contract that we are within the last paragraph of B. There's an
even though there's no summary judgment and there's no trial.
Your Honor, one of the interpretations that we've put forward is that the first two sentences are saying, if there is summary judgment, there's a requirement to on the firm to seek fees. The last sentence, I think, can be read. I'm not saying that it has to be read. It can be read, in an isolated way, similar to how FHC reads paragraph C. Putting that aside, I think if we're not there, we're in a gap. So I think we would say is if A doesn't cover it and B doesn't cover it, C
it's
just...
It's going to be a lot better if that last sentence of B was like its own. I mean, you're asking us to read the last sentence of B as if it's its own paragraph, but it's not. And C is its own paragraph.
Your Honor, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to write a contract, so I'm not disputing that point. And I think all we're really asking is I'm not asking you, Your Honor, today to adopt this reading of
this. You just want to find it ambiguous.
I think that this is something that ought to go to a jury to look at the extrinsic evidence. But when you look at paragraph C, I think it is important that it serves a different role. So it would be a little surprising to me if it does this really narrow thing, but also this really big thing, too.
Well, let me, I know since your time is limited, I think we have your argument in mind. I would like, let's just say hypothetically, and it's hypothetical. We haven't conferenced on the case, so I don't know what my colleagues think or I haven't expressed a view. So, but let's say hypothetically we agree with you that it's ambiguous. How does that affect what we would be required to do regarding Ms. Ling, because she has a default against her, and that contained in that default is the same interpretation of the contract that you're fighting here, right?
Right, Your Honor.
So what do we have to vacate that? Not because the normal reasons you would vacate a default, but because it has a faulty legal conclusion in it, or what's... Sure. Tell me what has to be done on the other part of it. You said you wanted to cover that before you sit down.
Sure, Your Honor. So I think, regardless of the interpretation, whether you agree with me that it's ambiguous or not and send it back, I think there's a problem with the judgment as to Ms. Ling. The district court entered a default judgment, but entered it, within our view, the wrong interpretation. The district court said, I'm sort of legally powerless to grant you the relief that you seek as a result of the default. So certainly and the reason of that was because the district court thought that the agreement was unambiguous and it meant what we're talking about today. So certainly if you disagree with that and you vacated, the judgment as to Ms. Ling would have to be vacated as well.
Same contract, though. So doesn't it all revolve around what we think, if we think the contract is ambiguous or unambiguous? Because it would seem to me if we agree with, is it Judge Gutierrez, I think? If we agree with Judge Gutierrez that it was unambiguous, then we don't really have to set aside the default, do we? Well, we would have to set it aside. Well, if we agree that it's unambiguous, then it's correctly included in the default. But if we say it's ambiguous like you want us to, then we would have to set it aside.
Your Honor, in our view, in both situations, you'd have to set it aside because there's a different problem with the judgment as to Ms. Ling. You know, under Rule 37, the district court had authority to enter a default judgment that was a punishment and a deterrent for discovery abuse, not because of the merits. So, you know, what we explained in our brief is that the district court erroneously, you know, made a legal decision that it could not award us the relief that we sought
already entered summary judgment and entered that order, so that's not, those merits were already established. Why is it that you are saying that in declining to award both attorney's fees, which were pretty substantial, and a one-third of Ms. Ling's part of the settlement, why are you saying that that reached the merits when the merits were already determined in an order?
Your Honor, it happened as a matter of fortuity because these, you know, two parties were part of the same case, that the district court happened, you know, to reach the summary judgment issue first and then the default judgment issue. If it had been reversed, I think the district court could have looked at this, said there was a complete and willful, you know, discovery violation here that warrants default judgment, and yeah, you get the remedy that you wanted. So we're making a very limited point here, which was the district court made a legal ruling that it was bound, you know, not to enter the relief that we requested because the court had already disagreed about the merits. The point of Rule 37 sanctions, you know, it says, you know, a different Rule 37 sanction is, you know, to bar a party from making a claim or a defense. You know, it disables a party from making a point about the merits, making claims on the merits. So in our view, it was just a legal error to say that the district court's views of the merits of the case, you know, affected its authority to enter the scope of the default judgment.
Can I ask a real quick question? So what is the difference between what you'll get if you were to get a third versus your fees? I think you said they'd get $775,000, which I can figure out what a third of that is, but what would your fees be?
Right, so there's two parties to the underlying False Claims Act case, the CRA.
There's the 504, too.
Yeah, but the 504 is not part of this and part of, you know, what we'd be talking about here. You know, there's the CRA, but then there's separately the City of Los Angeles. That hasn't been resolved yet, which is why we don't know. We don't know what the number is. We know that the demand has been very substantial.
Trying to figure out how there could be that big of a difference. But there's bigger stuff coming down the road, and this
will affect that. Your Honor, we have, you know, the email that's in the record of the $100 million demand that the Department of Justice had made. This is the Michelle White email that says, well, if Relman gets a third,
and this would all affect that, and whatever happens in this will all affect. Okay, that makes more sense. Why?
Well, I see I've gone beyond into my
time
as well.
Do either of my colleagues have additional questions? I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll hear from Fair Housing, and we'll put 11 minutes on the clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court.
Good morning.
I'm Don Warren. I represent the Fair Housing Council of San Fernando Valley. I'd like to talk about why it's not ambiguous and why C is a standalone paragraph and not a sub-paragraph to 1A. It is not a footnote to 1A, why it stands on its own.
If it had said in all other cases at the beginning of C, that would be better, wouldn't it? That makes it less ambiguous to me.
I don't think it makes it less ambiguous at all. The paragraph stands on its own. It is what's left in the contract. If A and B were not even in the contract because they've gone away because they don't apply, then you read directly from the opening paragraph, shall be calculated as follows. Reasonable fee shall be calculated as follows. And then you get to C, fee shall be calculated using the lodestar method. It's right there. It flows. And in fact, that C is standalone fee arrangement in the Roman firm's civil rights cases. They wrote a treatise about this. They tell other lawyers to use that as a standalone fee in their civil rights cases. And the deponents for the Roman firm admitted that this contract was drafted from that template, the civil rights template. If you look at the very first page of the fee agreement, it talks about seeking injunctive relief. There's no injunctive relief in the False Claims Act case. This came from their civil rights template.
Just so that I understand this, if the underlying case settles, is it correct that Relman would have no say in whether you agree to a settlement that provides for fees or not, or whether you waive your rights to seek court-awarded fees or not?
That's correct.
So if you assume the underlying case settles for a large monetary amount, as appellant has somewhat indicated as a possibility, as a practical matter, why would Relman agree to a provision that might yield two radically different fee awards under these circumstances, depending on what fee-related terms you agree to?
I can't speak to their mindset. All I can say is this was drafted from their civil rights fee agreement template, and they used it where the C language is always the contingency fee that the Relman firm agrees to accept in civil rights cases, because, as we all know, civil rights cases have a statutory fee provision, just like the False Claims Act has a statutory fee provision. That's their bread and butter, is seeking their hourly fees.
The False Claims Act, however, the fees can be waived only by the plaintiff, as opposed to 504, where that's not set out as an established right.
I believe that's not correct, Your Honor. Both in the in the civil rights cases, which would be the 504 case, and in the False Claims Act cases, the fee, the right to apply for fees, belongs to the client, not to the lawyer.
And so when you have a settlement agreement that includes a waiver, and that settlement agreement has been accepted by the plaintiff client, that is in order to induce that settlement, because it means that the defendant won't be paying out yet another sum of money. Is that right?
That situation can occur. We've seen that situation occur in our practice. We've been doing this for 30 years. We've seen that happen once or twice, where the almost a bankrupt defendant said, I'm pleading the empty pockets defense. I can't pay you. You got to make this all the way at once.
So Roman has kind of got this binary situation, waiver or no waiver. Paragraph A deals with waiver. There is no paragraph that deals with no waiver other than C.
That's correct.
That's your argument.
Yes, that's correct.
And so when you go back to the introductory sentence, the client agrees the firm is entitled to its reasonable attorney's fees in addition to costs, calculated as follows. And you have 1, 2, 3 calculated as follows.
Correct.
Was this negotiated, this fee agreement?
This fee agreement was drafted by the Relman firm and came pre-signed and with a blue ink signature on it to the Fair Housing Council. The Fair Housing Council, all of their experience was in civil rights cases where the lawyers have always accepted as their contingency fee the right to submit fees to the court. So this looked normal, and just like every fee agreement they'd ever seen before at the Fair Housing Council, seemed perfectly reasonable to them. So there was no discussion with the Relman firm. To answer your question, it just showed up pre-signed.
All right. So when you're talking about whether there is a gap or an ambiguity, but if we look at the Azagin case,
yes,
D.C., it seems to suggest or state that the gap filling takes place where the parties never contemplated a particular contingency. Are you saying that because of the way these civil rights cases, Fair Claims Act or 504, are set up, that that is not applicable because the parties are contemplating the contingency of waiver, of not waiver, of summary judgment, of trial, etc.? How does that work with
the in the False Claims Act scenario, which we're dealing with here? The client has the right to seek an hourly fee award from the defendant, or as ordered by the court to be paid by the defendant. It is, in my practice, 30 years, unheard of for a client who's going to get free hourly fees paid to it by the defendant to not seek those fees. It'd be absurd. It'd be ridiculous for a client not to seek those fees. happens in every single case unless the client's, the defendant's pleading empty pockets defense and asked you to waive them. So, of course, they knew that the client would seek hourly fees. I don't know why they wouldn't know that. That's not an unforeseen circumstance. I think the question is, if I may, Your Honor, I mean, unless you have...
Judge Van Dyke might have had a question.
I mean, there's two different ways something could be unforeseen. Something could be unforeseen and therefore not addressed in a contract in a sense of like... And then something could be unforeseen in a sense if it is addressed in the contract, but, you know, if you thought about it particularly, you may have written a different provision for that. And I think maybe this would fall into the latter category for your colleagues on the other side.
The Relman firm controlled what, as all lawyers do in contingency fee contracts, they control what contingency fee provisions they want to put in the contract at the outset, and they can propose whatever they want to the client. They can,
let me ask, kind of the timing here, you know, could seem suspicious. You know, like, it could be that somebody had read this and figured out, right, or sort of, we could keep a lot more of the money if we fired them now. And didn't. Is that what happened here, or was there some other reason for it?
It does not happen what happened there. And there's two parts to answer this question, Your Honor. And the chronology of who knew what when has been misstated from the get-go in the complaint and at every step of the way, and including the briefing of this court by the Relman firm. In False Claims Act litigation, there are periodic check-ins with the DOJ. Private counsel and DOJ check in on status of things. It's, I don't say all the time, but it's a regular, frequent event. And if you look at the sequence, we briefed this really well for the district court in the summary judgment. We had to truncate it for this court. But the DOJ counsel said, "Do you have time for a few minutes for a quick brief status update?" And the counsel wrote back to the DOJ, said, "Sure, what about Monday?" They said Friday or Monday would work. And the DOJ said, "Let's plan on Monday at 11 o'clock. That's all anybody knew about it. It was just another brief update. On Sunday, over that same, that was on a Friday, and on Sunday, that weekend, the termination occurred. Nobody knew anything other than it was going to be a brief update. It wasn't until after the fact on Monday that the DOJ counsel...
It's sort of like if the president calls me. Do I think that the president's going to call me and just say, "Hey, how you doing?" I mean, if DOJ's checking in, I mean, that seems... And let's just say it's settled the next day after that. The government comes in and settles the next day. Like, that we knew nothing about it just sort of flies in the face of... I mean... You're asking a lot.
The reality, Your Honor, of the way this works is we have phone calls with the government all the time. They ask us to brief things for them. They ask us to run down various things for them. They ask them about document interpretation, have our client deal with documents for them. These status calls happen all the time. It's not an unusual.
If you fire a lawyer, then you don't have a lawyer and you have to go find someone else. It just seems it's sort of like... When you leave your wife, is there someone else waiting in the wings? You know, I don't know. It's suspicious.
So the government didn't intervene for several more months.
Isn't that's
that
correct.
Right? How are you doing meeting that you were going to have that Monday?
I'm sorry, I did. What about
in the Monday meeting you were having with DOJ, I don't know that the record makes clear whether you were told at that time that the government would intervene.
They were not. The government hadn't made that decision. They didn't make that decision until, I believe, the summer. July, I think.
So the suspiciousness is eviscerated by about a six-month gap.
Oh, it has a six-month gap. And
so you didn't go get another lawyer, though? Were you just going to let it flounder?
The Fair Housing Council had real problems, and this is really briefed, and I encourage... to look at the 8 pages we cite from the referred to the district court briefing. This is a long history of an attorney-client relationship unraveling. We excerpt emails, quote emails, probably a dozen, 14, 15 emails from the Fair Housing Council saying, we can't trust these lawyers, we've got to get new lawyers, shame on you for acting like this, you lawyers.
Okay, we can look at that. So we probably spent a lot of time on that, but let me find out if my colleagues have any more questions. You're already in overtime, so let me find out what my colleagues...
Question.
Well, we can look at the record. Okay, let me find out if they have questions.
Thank you.
I'm good.
So I'll give you a minute to wrap up.
Thank you. To finish that question, the Fair Housing Council, because of their distrust for the Relman firm, it was an unraveling, a year and a half in the works. They spent $140,000 out of their own pocket to hire two lawyers to protect them and deal with the Relman firm on their behalf. And those lawyers were in place. They weren't just floundering pro se. They had lawyers in place. They ultimately found our firm in the late summer, fall, and retained us. So there's that. But as far as C, it's a standalone paragraph. It could have been drafted if Relman wanted to be a subparagraph to subparagraph A. It did not. Relman could have drafted it as a footnote to paragraph A. It did not. Relman could have drafted it with its own conditional limiting language, limiting its effect to subparagraph A. Relman did not. It stands alone.
Okay. Thank you for your argument. All right. Ms. Ling, you have 4 minutes. So once she puts it on the clock, I'm looking at the clock. And so I'll give you a 30-second warning, okay? So when you know you're close to wrapping up, go ahead.
Okay.
State your name.
First of all, my name is May Ling, and I thank you, Your Honors, for giving me the opportunity to...
And you're representing yourself.
It's just the court.
I can't hear you that well.
Yes.
Get right up there.
Yes, I am May Ling in Pepper, and thank you very much for allowing me to address the court. Because the Relman firm's agreement with Fair Housing Council is identical to its agreement with me, I will join in and concur with my co-relator's legal arguments of the interpretation of the contract, which also applies equally to me. However, there are three key points to correct and clarify from the Relman's appellant and reply briefs. The first one being that I did not pick a moment to terminate the Relman's firm when, as they say, the government was poised to intervene. Number two, I did not deny the Relman firm the opportunity to seek legal fees from the CRA, and I did not say that I never said that I would not allow the Relman firm to seek fees from the City of Los Angeles. Third, I request that the sanctions should not be imposed on me because of the default judgment. So going back to item one, relating to the Relman's belief that their termination was when they thought the government was going to intervene. This is not so, at least for me, because Scott Moore was retained by me in September 2012 after Michael Allen of the Relman firm told me that you can have it all. So he indicated to me that he was going to be stepping back. So I had to go out and find FCA counsel for myself, and that's why Scott Moore had come into the picture. So I had him as counsel from 2012, and little to no communication with the Relman firm. So their argument that they had been representing me for 6 years is just simply not true. I would like for the court to refer to item one of my request for judicial notice, which was filed and submitted by former attorney Scott Moore, having to do with the problems that we were experiencing with the Relman firm, which did necessitate having to get new counsel, and for many of the same reasons that Fair Housing Council, I did not know at the time, was experiencing, and that was briefed in their request for judicial notice, document 162, if you can kind of go through that, pages 22 to 25. There's just so many similarities that when Fair Housing Council and I actually, began speaking again in, I think it was September 2016, this is where I learned many things that there
were. You're at the 32nd warning.
Oh,
so okay. You need to wrap up.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
So, number one, the Rahman firm, they mischaracterized so many things because, first of all, as pointed out, the in 2016, we were planning to go forward on our own without the DOJ. And so when the DOJ learned that, that is when they claimed that they owned the case, but they did not intervene until 7.5 months later. So that was well after the Rahman firm was already terminated in December 2016. The item two that I wanted to cover was regarding the legal fees that they say that they were that they say that I did not allow them to have. I think if you look at my judicial notice, there's ample documentation to show that I had never refused for them to have legal fees. I only asked that they break down this 3x6-inch graph that they submitted. That's all they ever provided me was a calculation of what they thought they should get, none of which was ever broken down and itemized of what exactly they did. That was never provided to me, and I had asked for that multiple times, and Scott Moore had presented that to the CRA as well as to the Department of Justice, which is why, pursuant to state bar requirements, they had to provide me what did they do. And ultimately, they did get paid. They got paid, but however, they were expecting to double dip and be paid a second time by me. But the work that they did and the fees that they received were for both co-regulators, and they were not permitted to double bill. So it's inaccurate, that number one, they already got paid, and that was on the CRA part of the FCA case. There's still the City of LA case to come, and they can still get whatever statutory fees. It's going to come up somewhere for whatever they believe they did in that portion.
Okay, Ms. Ling, you're 2 minutes over. I've given you 2 extra minutes. So I'm just going to find out if my colleagues have any questions of you. Otherwise, you've used 2 minutes over.
No, I'm fine.
We don't. So that's going to conclude your argument.
All right.
All right, thank you. All right. You have 2 minutes for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few very quick points. I think it's telling that in Mr. Warren's argument, we heard immediately talking about the template that was used for this, the fact that, how it came pre-signed, that it was the Rahman firm that drafted the contract. These may very well be good jury arguments, but if we want to argue about what were the circumstances of contracting, what was the thought behind it, how was it prepared, that goes to the jury, and there's a lot of other extrinsic evidence, including that Mr. Allen, Michael Allen at the Rahman firm, had a conversation before the contract was signed explaining that in any circumstance we are taking the risk of doing this without payment up front.
Counsel, I think it's somewhat relevant to the idea that you're saying this is an ambiguous contract, but the fact that it's a form contract that you use a lot, somewhat cuts against that, I think, right? Otherwise, you're saying that, we've just been using this ambiguous contract.
We are. To be clear, I don't think that's established in the record that, this is a, for a False Claims Act versus, we're talking about the 504 case, which is completely different. It wouldn't make sense to have a contingency fee in the sense of, a one-third contingency in the 504 case where you don't have the same kind of potential for the government's share of a really substantial monetary award. So I don't agree with the premise. My point was simply that if you want to talk about that, this is not the time and the place for arguing about that.
Was this language, is your position of this language just crafted by you guys for this one case, or?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I can make a specific representation on that. I know that, as I mentioned before, paragraph A is intended to resolve, you know, a particular issue about, you know, this problem of a waiver of fees and needing to protect the firm in a settlement with a waiver scenario. But I'm not sure the record necessarily speaks to, you know, to that exactly. But I see I've taken my 2 minutes answering the question.
Either of you have any additional questions?
I have a question about Ms. Ling's statement that you can still get your fees against the city.
Your Honor, page 40 of the excerpts of record, we have a declaration of reporting a voicemail that Ms. Ling left saying very explicitly, you know, I'm not letting the Relman firm get a single penny from the city of Los Angeles. So, you know, I think, you know, we've seen kind of, you know, changes in position on that before, but, you know, I think that just is what it is. I realize I'm out of time. Could I say one word in response to just some of the, you know, substantive allegations that were made? Thank you, Your Honor. You know, I think this is not, you know, material to these issues, but I do think the Relman firm needs to state that it does not agree, of course, with these substantive allegations that were made against it. This was raised in the district court. FHC abandoned these claims. Ms. Ling did not. The district court found against her, found that there was no evidence for this. So I understand, you know, that all of this has been said, but the proof is really in the pudding. There's this very substantial monetary recovery, you know, owing to the Relman firm's work here, and the timing really is indeed suspicious that the new counsel was able to.
But when people say it's not about the money, it's all about the money.
Your Honor, I think in this case there was, you know, the Relman firm had done the work. There was something on the horizon, and then all of these things happened. So I think, you know, that you know.
Okay, I think we have all of the arguments in mind, and we do read everything. So, you know, for Ms. Ling, I would indicate to you, since you don't regularly come to court, that oral argument is always short like this. But the court does read all of the briefs and considers all of the record, and that's how we make our decision. And the comments that are made here we take into consideration as well. So that will conclude oral argument. Thank you all for your helpful comments and argument. And this matter will stand submitted, and this court is in recess until tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thank you.